Please, alone. He gestured for the others to go out for supplies, then turned and sprinted back upstairs. The loft looked darker than usual, as if all the light were being eaten by something. The movie posters resembled ghost portraits in a haunted mansion. Lawrence stepped in a beanbag and almost face-planted. He crept past machines that he worked with every day, which suddenly looked sinister with their sharp edges, metallic protrusions, and sputtering LEDs. There was a rank, beautiful scent, akin to burning lavender. Patricia glowed at the other end of the long, thin space, with the same pale light as the white circle where Priya had vanished. The only point of brightness in the entire space. "How's it going?" Lawrence Stage whispered, as though they were in a crypt. "It's going okay," Patricia said in a normal voice. "Priya is safe for now. She's going to need a lot of vodka and loud music when she gets out of where she is. She drinks, right? She's not straight edge." "She drinks," Lawrence said. That Priya's taste in intoxicants was an issue reassured him a lot, but he was waiting for the bad news. Patricia just stared at him as if she was trying to decide something. She was several inches shorter than him, but in this moment she seemed taller. Her deep-set eyes narrowed as she sized him up. "So," Lawrence said after a moment of this, "what can I do?" "Remember what I told you not to say to me," Patricia said, "when you brought me up here?" Lawrence had another standing on the edge of the abyss feeling. Total heedless terror. He shrugged, and it passed. "Sure," he said. "I remember." "I need you to owe me something," Patricia said, "or this won't work." "I'm really sorry. I tried to do it every other way, and none of them succeeded. In the end, the most powerful magic is often transactional in some way. I'll explain more some other time." "Okay, sure," Lawrence said. "Whatever you want. Name it." "If I bring your friend back," Patricia said. She chewed her lip and seemed to be trying one last time to think of an alternative. "If I bring your friend back, you have to give me the smallest thing you own." "That's it?" Lawrence laughed with relief. "Done." He grabbed her hand with both hands and shook. Lawrence couldn't stop laughing because he'd gotten himself all worked up and it turned out to be nothing. He owned so many tiny items. The smallest thing he owned was probably some ridiculous gadget he'd paid too much for. He laughed until he croaked and his eyes clouded, and when he wiped his eyes clear, Patricia and he were no longer alone. Priya stood on the white platform for a moment, gaping at the two faces below. She raised her elegant hands to her face, as if astonished to see that she still had hands. She tried to form words and just made a fish mouth instead. She started to wobble off the platform, and Lawrence guided her to sit down. "She's seen some things that eyes weren't built for," Patricia said. "Like I said, vodka, and lots of it. And loud music. I recommend benders. I'll even come and have a drink or two." Lawrence steered Priya onto a beanbag, where she was hugging herself and making low guttural sounds. He texted the others to come back up, then turned back to Patricia. "Oh my God, thank you," Lawrence said. "Am I allowed to say thank you, or is that bad?" "You're allowed to say thank you," Patricia laughed. He ran over and hugged her so tight he nearly squeezed the life out of her, and he felt her bare shoulders against his chest and her face against his neck. She made a slight protesting squick noise, and Lawrence slackened a tiny bit, but kept hugging her. "Thank you, thank you, thank you." Lawrence's eyes felt splashy his senses filled with clementines and softness and warmth. He blessed the day his parents decided he should be outdoorsy. The others had come back, and Saugata was life-preserving Priya with tears rushing down his face. "I thought I'd lost you forever. I couldn't have lived with myself. I never want to let go of you," he said. "There were colors outside the visual spectrum," Priya managed to say, "but I could still see them. I can't stop seeing them now." "Vodka and loud music," Patricia called out from Lawrence's death grip. "Stat! It's an essential part of her recovery process." They rushed Priya to Bender's Bar and Grill. There was some talk of going to the ER instead, but Patricia nixed it, and nobody wanted to argue with the person who'd saved all their asses.
"But how did you do it?"
Anya kept asking. "What did you do?"
"I used my sonic screwdriver."
"No, really. What did you do?"
"I reversed the polarity of the neutron flow."
"Stop giving Doctor Who answers. Tell me the truth."
"It was sort of a wibbly-wobbly," Patricia said, fully teasing Anya now.
Booze really was medicinal, after a near-death experience. Holding a drink in both hands and letting it corrode the topmost layer of his mouth and throat, Lawrence felt a spiritual relationship with Bushmills. Priya, too, seemed to be pretty much back to normal as soon as she had a couple swigs of vodka and heard the sound system blasting, "Come on, feel the noise." She started dancing on her stool and making jokes about heavy metal hair and body shots. Lawrence made sure the liquor kept coming, so Priya would get her recommended dosage. Whatever she'd experienced during her time outside of our universe, she seemed to be rinsing it out of her mind. And maybe if they were lucky, the whole evening would feel like a weird blur to her when she woke with a hangover. As a strategy for scrambling someone's short-term memories, it didn't seem bad. Everybody kept toasting Patricia and buying her drinks and laughing at her dumb jokes as if they were ultra-conscious that she'd pulled their fat out of the fire. When Patricia went to the ladies, Saugata leaned over and said to Lawrence, "Seriously, where did you find her? She is amazing. She's like the weirdest genius I've ever met, and that's actually saying something." Tanea and Anya both chimed in, but at the same time, Lawrence noticed that none of his friends would quite look at Patricia, and they kept talking past her rather than to her. These people hated superstition, but they were treating his friend like a bad luck charm. Patricia watched Priya like a freaking hawk and touched her hand every now and then as if her touch had healing properties, which it probably did. Patricia paid no attention to the rest of them, even Lawrence. Patricia might be an antisocial weirdo who wandered at 3 a.m. talking to rats, but she had unlimited gentleness for people when they needed it. Patricia's black hair was swept back, and her face had a beacon-like quality to it that went along with the intentness of her gaze. Lawrence had a moment of counting up how many of his secrets Patricia knew, and feeling good about it. He felt a weird sense of pride that he had found someone he trusted so much, like he'd chosen well, even if it was mostly by accident. He walked her home, fighting the urge to embrace her randomly. She was laughing and shaking her head. "God, it was iffy for a few moments there," she said. "Your friend got pretty lost. Plus, it's a miracle she didn't get squashed by the weird gravitational effects of the space she was in." "I wonder how many other things in our world are just the shadows of things in other places," Lawrence said, forming the thought as he spoke. "I mean, we always suspected that gravity was so weak in our world, because most of it was in another dimension. But what else? Light, time, some of our emotions? I mean, the longer I live, the more I feel like the stuff I see and feel is like a tracing of the outline of the real stuff that's beyond our perceptions."
"Like Plato's cave," Patricia said.
"Like Plato's cave," Lawrence agreed. I don't know, Patricia said. I mean, we're grown-ups now, allegedly, and we feel things less than we did when we were kids, because we've grown so much scar tissue. Or our senses have dulled. I think it's probably healthy. I mean, little kids don't have to make decisions, unless something's very wrong. Maybe you can't make up your mind as easily if you feel too much, you know? But in fact, Lawrence was feeling sensations and emotions more vividly than he had since he was little. The streetlights and car headlights and neon signs were blazing with life, and he felt his heart expand and contract, and he could smell charcoal burning someplace nearby. He turned to look into Patricia's bright, sad smile. "Patricia," he said, "I really, really appreciate your help. And more than that, I am so damn glad to know you. I am so sorry I ran out on you when you talked to your cat when we were kids. I will never run out on you again. That's a promise I'm giving you, free and clear. I'm probably not supposed to make promises to someone like you either, right? But I don't care. Thank you for being my friend."
"You're welcome," Patricia said. They had reached her front door.
"Same to you. All of it. I'm super lucky to have you as a friend, too. And I'll never run out on you, either." They stood at her door. At some point, their hands had started touching, and they just stood there, looking at each other, hands in hands. Patricia's smile turned sadder, as if she knew something that Lawrence hadn't figured out yet. "Don't forget the thing you owe me," she said. "Or it'll be very bad. I'm sorry." Then she went inside her house, and the door slammed shut. Lawrence was still jangling with a mixture of tipsiness, relief, and emotional gushiness the whole way home. But he was also feeling a smidge uneasy about the smallest thing. No big deal, most likely, but Patricia had seemed kind of intense about it. Lawrence actually clicked his heels together as he crossed the street in big, hungry strides. He had never done ecstasy or any kind of mood elevator, but he sort of imagined this is how they would feel. When he got home, he crashed. The elation wore off so fast he had to sit down. He was so drained, he felt like he was going to pass out if he didn't get to sleep right away. And then he thought about the smallest thing that he had to give to Patricia. He could look for it in the morning, or in a couple days, or whatever. She hadn't specified a time limit, or anything. He probably had a few days to find it. But then Lawrence started wondering what it could be, and how he was supposed to know. Was it the smallest by volume, by weight, or just overall size? He owned some pieces of lint that were beyond tiny, but he was pretty sure that wouldn't count. To be fair, he had to pick something he owned, which meant something that had at least a nominal resale value. You don't own something you couldn't sell, right? So, he had a USB drive that he'd brought home from the 10% project office, which was the size of two peas, but when he texted Patricia, she said it couldn't be something he'd borrowed. She needed something he owned himself, free and clear. That ruled out the electronic components and tools littering his desk and shelves, which were all technically on loan from Milton. Lawrence rummaged through his desk. Pencils, pens. That little figurine of Mega Man was pretty tiny. Move that to the top of the list. He started a pile and rummaged through drawers and boxes and closet shelves, trying not to wake Isabel. And then, all at once, he knew. "Oh, no," he said aloud. "Not that. No, no, no. Fuck. Fuck, no." He couldn't breathe, like an asthma attack or something. All of the joy he'd felt earlier slipped away as if it had never been there, and he felt instead like he'd been kicked in the solar plexus with a sharp steel toe. He stayed up most of the rest of the night, searching and searching, but he never found anything that counted as a real possession and was smaller than his grandmother's ring. He brought it to Patricia the next morning, eyes sore from lack of sleep. "This is the only thing I have of my grandmother's," he told her. "She gave it to me when she was dying."
"I'm sorry," Patricia said.
She stood in the doorway of her apartment building, in a bathrobe. Maybe he'd woken her, but he doubted it. "She said it was her mother's, and she wanted to pass it down to a granddaughter, but I was her only grandchild," Lawrence said. "She wanted me to give it to whoever I married, and then to our daughter, if we had one."
"I'm really sorry," Patricia said.
"I was going to give it to Serafina," Lawrence said, "as an engagement ring. I promised my grandma I would give it to my bride."
Patricia didn't say anything, just stared in her purple robe. Her hair was a pile of tangles.
"I really have to give it to you? We can't just call it quits?"
"You really have to, or your friend might get sucked back into that place, or you might instead."
When she put it like that, the ring was a pretty small price to pay. "You knew it was going to be this."
He handed it to her, still in its tiny, tiny velvet box.
Actually, with the box, it was almost bigger than a toy car he owned, but not quite.
"I knew it would be something like this."
Patricia put the ring into the pocket of her robe, where it barely made a lump.
"Or the spell wouldn't have worked."
"Why couldn't it just be something like, I have to stand on 1 foot for an hour? Why does it have to be my most valued possession and the linchpin of my courting strategy? It doesn't make any sense."
"Do you want to come in and have some toaster waffles?"
Patricia stepped back and held the door open.
"I can't talk about this out here, in the open."
The toaster waffles failed to materialize, but instead she had locally made organic Pop-Tarts, which were probably better. They sat on the gray, lumpy sofa, where Dee Dee and the other roommate had been watching Jersey Shore every other time Lawrence had been there. Patricia kept glancing over toward the hallway for any signs they were stirring or listening in to this conversation.
"So I might have mentioned there are two kinds of magic."
Patricia handed Lawrence a blueberry pastry and a mug of English breakfast. "Good and bad, I'm guessing," said Lawrence, not quite having his mouth full. Patricia's bathrobe was splayed out on the sofa next to him, and he wondered if he could grab the ring while she wasn't looking. But then he remembered the part about someone getting pulled back into the nightmare dimension.
"No, though that's a common misconception. There's healer magic and trickster magic. Back in the day, many people believed healer magic was good and trickster magic was evil. But healers can be judgmental control freaks, and tricksters can be super compassionate and basically save your life."
"Like last night," Lawrence said.
Patricia nodded. "The healer and trickster schools formed over hundreds of years, out of lots of local traditions from all over the world. And there was a time, in the 1830s, when the two groups went to war. The world could have been torn apart. But there was this woman named Hortense Walker who realized that the two types of magic worked better if you could combine them. You could do amazing things if you mastered both trickster and healer magic, way more than you could do with either type alone. Plus, you were less likely to go over the edge into becoming a control freak or a lying jerkface." Lawrence was already jumping ahead to the implications.
"So if you want to accomplish something major using magic, you need to trick someone or heal them. So you're helpless without a patsy or a sick person."
"I wouldn't say helpless. I spent years training to use these skills in lots of different situations. I can use trickster magic to transform myself, even with nobody around. And if someone attacked me, I could heal them so hard they'd feel it for a week."
"Thanks for explaining."
Lawrence ate the last corner of his blueberry pouch and then washed it down with the rest of the tea. He had 100 more questions, but he wasn't equipped to hear any more answers right now. He sank deeper into the broken upholstery of the couch. He would never, ever be able to pull his butt out of this sofa. He was just going to get dragged in deeper until he was swallowed, as if by a Venus ass trap. Every quadrant of Lawrence's soul was yelling for him to get the hell out of there before he lost more than his grandmother's ring and his freedom of speech. But then he thought about the other promise he'd made the night before, the one he made of his own free will. "I said I wouldn't ever run away again," Lawrence said. "And I won't." "Good." Patricia let out a breath that sounded like she'd held it for ages. "More tea?" "Sure." Lawrence found a marginally more comfortable arrangement on the couch, and Patricia handed him a fresh hot mug. They drank tea together in silence until Patricia's roommates woke up and started giving Lawrence the hairy eyeball. Chapter 22. Patricia had spent years wishing she could run away to learn real magic. Then one day, she turned herself into a bird, and a man came to take her to the Witch Academy. Dreams? Fulfilled. El Tisley Mays had two separate campuses, and they were as different as a cloudless summer day and a blizzard. El Tisley Hall had grand stone buildings over 600 years old, and nobody ever raised his or her voice there. Students at El Tisley walked single file along the gravel walkways, wearing blazers, ties, and shorts, with the school's crest over their hearts, a bear and stag face to face, holding a flaming chalice between them. You addressed your teachers or upperclassmen as sir or miss, and ate in formal hall in the greater building. The maze, meanwhile, was a disorienting jumble of nine-faced buildings and looping walkways where you could wear whatever you pleased. You could sleep all day, do drugs, play video games, do anything you fancied, except that you would find yourself trapped in a room with no door or toilet for weeks until you learned some crazy lesson. Or you would be tossed into a bottomless pit or chased around for days by people with sticks. Or you would find yourself unable to stop tap dancing. Or pieces of you might start falling off, one by one. Nobody told you anything in the maze. Once, El Tisley Hall and the maze had been two separate schools, representing two styles of magic that were at odds. But now they were joined, because magic had been united, at great cost. The passage between them was a sandy, hedge-lined walkway that only opened at certain times. Patricia would spend weeks mastering some delicate healing art at El Tisley Hall, and then they would send her back to the maze, and she would be so confused and tangled up in herself that she forgot all her fancy skills. She would solve some nonsense puzzle at the maze, and figure out how to do some clever trick, only to be sent back to El Tisley Hall, where they'd drum endless rules and formula into her again, and she would lose the twisty shape she'd been holding in her mind. This would have been enough to make her cry into her pillow every night at Lights Out, at El Tisley, or impromptu nap time at the maze. But also, Patricia missed her parents, whom she hadn't even said goodbye to. For all they knew, she was dead, or living in some alley like an animal. She wanted to tell them she was okay, but she wouldn't know how to explain. Not to mention, she'd left her cat, Berkeley. The head teacher at El Tisley Hall was a gentle old lady named Carmen Edelstein. She wore her silver hair in a dignified page boy and always had an elegant silk wrap around her neck and shoulders. Carmen encouraged the students to come to her with any problems or questions, and Patricia soon found herself confiding in the old lady. But she learned the hard way that she must not mention her encounter with some sort of tree spirit a few years earlier. Magic was a practice and an art, not a spiritual belief system. You might have your own private spiritual experiences, just like any normal person, but believing you had a direct line to something great and ancient was the beginning of aggrandizement.
trees. Do not talk to people," said Carmen Edelstein, her usual cheer replaced by a worried scowl. "You had a hallucination, or someone was playing a trick. This is why it's terrible that we get so many students so late, after they have already experimented on their own. Those bad habits can be a nightmare to unlearn." "It was probably a hallucination, sure." Patricia squirmed in her stiff chair. "I remember I had eaten a lot of spicy food." The head teacher at the maze was Knote, whose face and voice changed every time you met him. Sometimes he was an elderly Sri Lankan man, sometimes a pygmy, sometimes a giant white man with a crazy neckbeard. Patricia soon learned to recognize Knote by certain tells, like the way he rolled his shoulders or narrowed his left eye. If you failed to identify him or misidentified someone else as him, you would find yourself at the bottom of the deepest pit in the maze. Other than the bottomless one, that is. People said that if Knote ever wore the same face twice, he would die. Whenever you met Knote, he'd offer you a terrible bargain. Patricia didn't try to tell Knote about the tree. Patricia had no real friends at El Tisley Maze. She was friendly with a few of the other kids, including Taylor, who had messy, mouse-brown hair and ungainly, twitchy arms and legs. But the main cliques at the school never found a place for Patricia, especially after it was clear that she kind of sucked at most of the school assignments. Nobody wanted to befriend someone who was both nerdy and bad at homework. If you went out into the tree line near El Tisley Hall at a certain time in the late afternoon, or after lights out in the El Tisley dorm, you might have seen a teenage girl with dark brown hair and big, wondering eyes looking up at the trees and saying, "Are you here? What's your deal? Is Parliament in session?" And chattering to the birds, which just glanced at her and flew away. You could never tell how long you would spend at either El Tisley Hall or the maze. It could be days, weeks, or longer. At one point, Patricia spent 7 months in the maze, until she managed to hide from the teachers and the other students, and they all spent a week looking for her. But instead of going back to El Tisley Hall, she was led out into a yellow grass field, where Knote himself ushered Patricia and some other students into a great wooden airship, which was whale-shaped, except it had more fins, with an interior that was covered with rococo nuts and berries. Today, Knote was a heavy-set, bespectacled African-American man with a Tennessee accent and a bomber jacket. "Here's the idea," he said, when they were already over the Alps somewhere. "We drop each one of you guys in a small town, some place where you don't speak the language. No money, no supplies. And you find a person who needs healing. Someone hurting real bad. And you heal them. Without them knowing you were ever there. Then we come get you." Knote offered to let the students out of this assignment in exchange for letting him hide some stuff in their bones. But nobody went for it. So instead, he started shoving kids one by one out of the airship's hatch, which looked like the doorway of a French chateau a few hundred feet up. No parachute. Patricia managed to slow her descent, so the impact just knocked the wind out of her. She staggered to her feet, in a field miles from anywhere. Then she wandered until nightfall, when she saw the lights of the town behind her. The first few people she found seemed healthy enough, but then she noticed an old woman hunched over a bowl of soup in a small restaurant or bistro. The woman was coughing, and her skin looked gray, and Patricia could glimpse an ochre scar poking out of the neck of her yellow blouse. Perfect. Patricia crept toward the woman, only to get a face full of soup and what sounded like accusations of thievery in some Slavic language. She ran. A week later, Patricia was starving and running out of places to hide in this town, with its dingy white plaster walls and muddy roads. She could no longer talk to animals, and she had failed to master the skill of understanding human languages other than English. Plus, she could only heal a sick person with whom she'd built a certain rapport. I am so not going to sleep in these same clothes again tonight, Patricia said aloud, in English. The shopkeeper in the tiny grocery saw her and chased her out, shouting guttural syllables. Patricia ran down the narrow twisting streets, sharp inclines paved with cobblestones, until she had lost the shopkeeper. She squatted behind a stone wall and looked at the only thing she'd been able to steal. A dusty bottle of Chiang Mai brand chili oil. This better work. Patricia tilted the bottle so the words, "Warning, red hot," were upside down. The thick liquid singed her throat. She started to gag, but she made herself drink the whole thing. Once the bottle was empty, she pulled herself into a shivering ball. Her head ached. She wanted to weep for everything she'd lost and all she'd failed to gain. An hour later, she raised her head and threw up. Once she started, she couldn't stop. Her eyes burned and her nose ran, and the oil was twice as horrible coming up as going down. Her stomach spasmed, not amused by her idea of a meal after days of starvation. She coughed acid. The good news. Patricia had an idea how to heal the angry old woman now. Patricia crept across the slate rooftops of the town until she reached the sloping roof of the cantina, where she could see the woman through a small skylight. The skylight was open, and she slipped inside, tiptoeing across a loft where bags of flour and cans of supplies were stored. She hesitated before taking some bread and stuffing it in her mouth. Then she reached the edge of the loft, still on the other side of the glorified barn from where the woman sat at her rickety table. Patricia shinnied up a support pillar and then onto a ceiling beam. She inched her way across the beam until she was hanging by her arms and legs over the old woman and leaned as far as she could without losing her grip. Patricia spat in the old woman's soup. The old woman was hectoring someone else in the room, probably about kids these days, and didn't notice. Once Patricia's saliva was inside the woman, she had a direct link and could take stock of the late-stage emphysema. The barely-in-remission cancer that had already cost the old woman a lung, and the gout. It took an hour of concentration and some unseemly muttering for Patricia to get in there and make the woman's insides as good as new. She stopped just short of giving the crone a lung to replace the one she'd lost. The night sky looked overcrowded to Patricia as she lay in the uneven grass of the field where she'd fallen out of the airship. Too many stars, trying too hard. She lay there for an hour before the airship descended far enough to lower a ladder for her. She climbed slowly, her limbs sore and feeble. Connaught handed her a sandwich and a can of ginger ale and tried to sell her some shares in a Zumba studio. This time, Connaught was a young German with a shaved head. After that, Patricia started figuring out how to use the things she'd learned at El Tisley at the maze, and how to use the maze's craftiness at El Tisley. A few kids had dropped out after the random Eastern European town assignment, so space opened up for Patricia to become an honorary member of a few cliques. One night, she was smoking clove cigarettes with the cool goth kids after curfew, inside the cavernous and never-used chimney of El Tisley's lesser building. There was Diantha, the plump, swan-like leader of the group, who was rumored to be the daughter of an earl or something. Next to Patricia sat Taylor, who'd gone full-on goth with the hair dye and eyeliner and a leather jacket after hours. On Patricia's other side was Samir, who wore black starched collar shirts that made his shy, slightly horsey face look grown up and sophisticated. Plus Toby, a Scottish kid with wiry red hair and jug ears, and a few other kids who showed up sometimes. The red brick chimney walls had streaks of ancient soot on them. Patricia and Taylor rested, arms around each other, and the clove smoke fumigated Patricia's insides. They were trading weird stories about their lives before El Tisley Maze, all the fluky experiences that made them realize they had a connection to some unidentified power. And Patricia found herself talking about what she remembered of the parliament of Derpa Derpa Weepalong and the tree, before she even knew what she was doing. That is bizarre, Taylor said.
It is quite amazing, said Diantha, leaning forward and encompassing Patricia with her dark, enthralling eyes. Do tell us more.
Patricia told the whole story again, from the beginning, adding more details this time. The next day, she wondered if she should have kept the tree thing to herself. Was she going to get in trouble? She kept glancing at Carmen Edelstein during literature class. They were reading Troilus and Cressida, but Carmen showed no sign of knowing anything. That night, as Patricia was getting ready for bed, Taylor knocked on her door.
Come on, we're all at the chimney,
Taylor said with a grin. The group in the disused chimney was twice as big as before, so there was barely room for Patricia. But everybody wanted to hear about the tree. The more times Patricia told the story, the more like a story it became, with dramatic touches and a better ending. She threw in more details, like the way the wind felt as it passed through her disembodied spirit form, and the way the trees shimmered as she soared on the wind into the heart of the forest. And by the third night, when Patricia was telling the story to a third group of kids, the tree had gotten a lot more eloquent.
"It said you were the protector of nature?"
said a younger kid from Côte d'Ivoire named Jean-Jacques.
"It said we all were," Patricia said. "The defenders of nature. Against, like, anyone who wanted to harm it. We all are. We have a special purpose. That's what the tree said, anyway. It was like the perfect tree at the heart of the forest that you can only find if someone shows it to you. A bird took me when I was very small."
"Can you take us to it?"
asked Jean-Jacques, so excited he couldn't breathe. Soon they had a proper club. They got together at night, a dozen kids, and talked about how they were going to find the heart of the forest, the way Patricia had. And how they were going to protect nature from anyone who wanted to harm her, like the Na'vi. Patricia was the one with the knowledge, but Diantha was the one who could say, "We are all of one accord," and everybody would cheer.
"We are all counting on you,"
Diantha said to Patricia in low, confiding tones, touching her shoulder. Patricia felt a thrill all the way down to her tailbone.
"And the tree was huge, like 40 or 50 feet tall, and it wasn't an oak or a maple or any kind I'd seen before. It had branches like big wings, and the moonlight came through the thickest part of the branches in two places, so it looked like two glowing eyes looking at me. The voice was like this friendly earthquake."
The 10th time that Patricia told the story about the night after she left her body and went to the tree, the tale had gotten embroidered to the point where it bore little resemblance to the version Patricia had told that first night. And yet, everybody was bored with it. They wanted to know what happened next.
"What do we do?" Samir asked. "What's our next move?"
"I honestly don't know," Patricia said. She told them, for the first time, about when she was in Bogtown and she guzzled chili oil and nothing happened. They traded theories, like it wasn't the right time, or she wasn't in the right headspace, or you couldn't reach the tree from Eastern Europe because of ley lines. Opinions among Diantha's secret club were divided over the crucial question. Did the adults at El Tisley Maze know about the tree? Either, A, it was something all the adults knew about, and they were just keeping it secret from the kids because they weren't ready to know about it yet, or, B, they didn't know about it, and this was something you had to be a kid to understand. A few days later, Patricia had lunch with Diantha, alone. They had a blanket on the east lawn of El Tisley Hall, where every blade of grass was perfect. Patricia still couldn't quite believe that Diantha was hanging out with her. Diantha had this way of widening her eyes just before saying something to you, so you found yourself looking into her gaze and you felt sure that whatever she said next would be the most important thing you'd ever heard. She wore her El Tisley scarf so elegantly, you'd think she'd picked it out of 1,000 scarf options. Her brown hair caught the light. We're going to do so many great things together, you and I. I just know it.
Diantha told Patricia.
You should have some fizzy lemonade. They don't have fizzy lemonade where you're from, and it's really quite good.
Patricia did what she was told. The lemonade was like a more lemony Sprite, and it was the coolest thing. The bubbles popped on her tongue. Patricia wondered if Diantha was going to kiss her. Diantha was leaning in close, and they were gazing into each other's eyes. Patricia had never thought of herself as lesbian, but Diantha smelled so good and had such a powerful presence. It wasn't even like paltry sexual attraction. Somewhere off in the distance, a bird sang, and Patricia almost understood. Even the kids who didn't hang out in the disused chimney gave Patricia a look of envy or appreciation when she walked into the El Tisley dining hall, or when she foraged in the self-service canteen at the maze, where you never knew if there would be pizza or black pudding. People in the maze told Patricia they liked her jeans. Nobody had ever liked her jeans before.
I have something very important to tell all of you.
Diantha sounded breathless, and not just because there were 10 teenagers packed inside a dirty little chimney at midnight. 10 pairs of hands clutched, 10 pelvises twitched with anticipation, as if they all collectively had to pee. Diantha held the pause as long as she could, then dropped the bomb.
I have spoken with the tree.
What? Patricia said before she could stop herself. I mean, that's great. How did you manage to do that? Everybody was staring at Patricia, like she'd had a jealous outburst or something, instead of just being surprised. It wasn't that Patricia had a monopoly on talking to the tree or anything. She had only done it once herself, and that was years ago. Patricia stammered something else about how happy she was that Diantha had done it, because this was great news, really great. Diantha made things 100 times worse, patting Patricia on the knee and saying, "Don't worry, dearest. We still value your contribution most of all." But screw Patricia's wounded pride. Everybody wanted to know, what had the tree said? What was the message? They were so ready. They were beyond ready.
"The tree said," Diantha said, "to prepare ourselves. The test is coming soon. And not all of us will pass it, but those who do will be heroes, forever and ever."
Everybody was so happy, they were whimpering. That didn't sound like the way the tree had talked to Patricia, at all. But she'd only had one conversation a few years ago, and she had a dim recall of the details, especially now that she'd retold them so many times. Patricia told herself to feel glad that she'd been vindicated, and she hadn't just hallucinated the whole thing after all, instead of asking Diantha a bunch of questions, which would just be a sign of jealousy and aggrandizement. Now the tree was talking to Diantha instead of Patricia. Big whoop.
"I was up all night studying for a healing tonics exam," said Diantha. "And I ate a great quantity of spicy papadum crisps. The next thing I knew, I was soaring out of my body, out the window, into the night. It was the most exhilarating sensation."
For a fortnight, the tree wasn't forthcoming with any more information, although it spoke to Diantha a few more times. Samir held hands with Patricia as they listened to the hints that this was something ancient, from before any of the lore they studied, from before words. Samir's hand felt dry and calloused, and his index finger touched Patricia's pinky in a way that made her feel funny inside. They were both fixated on Diantha, whose exquisite nostrils flared as she talked about her out-of-body experience. On Patricia's other side, Taylor shivered. Everybody who met in that chimney had a secret wink. Where you put your thumb in the middle of your collarbone while you winked with one eye, then the other. And they wrote sigils inside their clothes. When the tree did give Diantha actual instructions, they were cryptic.
It said, "Stop the pipe and passage."
Her eyes widened, and she looked supercharged with adrenaline.
It repeated every word twice. The Pipe and Passage? Said Samir. That sounds like a gentleman's club, full of tobacco smoke and secret entrances.
It sounds obscene, yeah?
Said Toby the Ginger. He made a motion to show how pipe and passage could be construed smuttily. Diantha gave him a glance that made him fold inward. They spent days debating and Googling and whispering the words pipe and passage to one another, with no idea what they could mean. Diantha seemed impatient, as though she was waiting for someone else to figure out the meaning, so she wasn't forced to be messenger and interpreter both. At last, on Friday after lights out, Diantha took a drag on a clove cigarette and announced she had the answer. Pipe, it turned out, referred to the Great Siberian Natural Gas Pipeline, and passage referred to the Great Northern Shipping Passage. They were both the brain children of Lamar Tucker, a Texan who had helped pioneer slick water fracking, in partnership with a Russian conglomerate called Vilkitsky Shipping. The Russians wanted a new shipping route to replace the Northwest Passage, one that avoided Canada altogether, going through the heart of the Arctic ice. There was just one catch. Their route went straight through a massive deposit of ancient methane clathrate in the Chukchi Sea that had been trapped under the ice for millions of years. Scientists warned that releasing all that methane at once could supercharge the effects of climate change overnight. Hence the pipeline. Tucker believed you could drill down by inches, release the pressure slowly, and trap the still-frozen methane by bonding it with silicates. Then you could pipe the energy-rich methane sludge to a facility in Yakutsk. You'd generate enough electricity to power half of eastern Russia, and maybe sell surplus power to Mongolia, China, or even Japan.
But it's going to go wrong. I know it, said Diantha. They have no idea what they're tampering with. They must be stopped.
Yes, said Patricia, but what are we supposed to do?
Do? Said Diantha. Look around. We are the best students at El Tisley Maze. Between all of us, we have mastered so many skills. Toby, I have seen you unmelt the last snows of spring and reverse 3 days' decay. Samir, you once tricked a bank manager into giving you £500 and the power of invisibility. Patricia, I have heard the teachers whisper that you have a connection to nature that even they don't fully understand. We can do this. The tree depends on us.
They set off that very night, with only what they could carry. Diantha insisted there could be no delaying and no chance for anybody to have a change of heart and tell the teachers. They all went back to their rooms at El Tisley Hall and stuffed random objects into duffel bags.
"Where are we even going?" Toby said. "I have a practical in 2 days."
"At El Tisley,
where they expect you to show up."
"We're going AWOL,"
said Taylor with a very quiet whoop.
"No more tests, no more tutorials, no more math class, no more lectures, and no more puzzles at the maze, until we finish our mission."
Patricia stuffed a toothbrush and 3 pairs of underwear, plus a tattered copy of Tales of the City, into her satchel. She was going on an adventure. She was going to make a difference. She almost danced down the mahogany staircase in the north residential wing of El Tisley Hall, except that Samir kept shushing her. She squirmed with adrenaline as they broke into the magic airship and spoofed their way past the security questions.
"Hell to the yeah," Patricia said as they spiraled up off the ground. "Let's do this."
She and Taylor high-fived, and then Patricia and Samir hugged while Diantha laughed from the cockpit, whose controls were wooden grapevines and figs. The expedition didn't feel real until they were over the Arctic and the moonlight had given way to 2 sheets of sunlight, sky and ice, both painful to behold. Patricia's joy went sour. She looked out at the vastness below and couldn't tell one bright streak from another.
We have to hit them before they know we're here, Diantha said from the cockpit. I hope everybody is prepared for any eventuality.
Patricia, Toby, Samir, and Taylor all said yes.
We're doing the right thing, Taylor said as they sat down. We've studied long enough.
Patricia was wishing she'd brought another 3 layers of clothing. She could do a spell to keep herself warm, but it would be a distraction. She wound her scarf around her neck and lower face as many times as it would go.
Toby, you're on transmutation of metals, because you're our best healer. If it's steel, you turn it to tin, Diantha said as they stepped out of the ship. Samir and Taylor, you will confuse and confound any opposition we may encounter. I will attempt to seal any borehole in a spectacularly irreparable fashion. And Patricia, you will bring the full fury of nature down on them. Be creative.
They all high-fived and set off across the tundra toward the drilling installation, which looked like a lighthouse on the ice, with a single rusty structure on top of a platform, supported by 4 squat legs connected by the lower half of a pentagram. On one side of the drill was some kind of pumping station with a bulging metal sleeve. On the other side, Patricia saw a huge diesel tank that had probably been airlifted there, and a number of snowmobiles and retrofitted trucks. Looking at a massive tank marked, Warning, Highly Flammable, sitting on top of the world's largest reservoir of methane, Patricia shivered. Her apprehension shaded into terror.
Guys, Patricia said, I think we ought to stop and...
Someone yelled in Russian, and dogs were barking. Guys wearing parkas and goggles drove toward them in a couple snowmobiles, waving what looked like machine guns. Samir and Taylor nodded and ran into their path. A moment later, the guards opened fire, but wildly, in random directions, because Samir had done something to confuse them.
Watch out! Patricia shouted. Don't make them shoot their own fuel t-
But she couldn't make herself heard over the gunfire, the engines, the yelling, and the dog pack. Toby was already running toward the massive drill, crafting a transmutation of metals spell. Meanwhile, Diantha was marching toward the drill as well, a look of total determination on her beautiful, sun-drenched face. A bullet caught her in the side, and she keeled over. Patricia ran and crouched next to Diantha, who was bleeding like a fountain and panting.
Hang on, Patricia said. Looks like the bullet went clean through, but I'm afraid it hit an artery. Hold tight.
Don't waste time on me, Diantha said. The mission. Focus on the mission.
Patricia kissed Diantha on the mouth, while her hands groped for the hole that was gushing blood. She found the artery and painstakingly, clumsily, repaired it. A bullet sliced past her face. She broke the kiss and said,
Tell me the truth. Did the tree talk to you at all?
Diantha said,
That's a terribly rude question, especially at this juncture.
A shout sounded like Toby.
It's all down to you now, Diantha said. Make them feel the fury.
Diantha passed out. Patricia looked up, keeping Diantha's head cradled in her lap. Samir and Taylor had done such a good job creating confusion, she couldn't see what was going on. Snow churned through the air in big tidal waves, and a huge dog, like a husky, sprinted in front of Patricia and then tumbled head over heels. The sound of gunfire was near continuous, like the loudest white noise ever. The wall of snow cleared a little, and Patricia saw a body face down in the snow, wearing an Eltisli scarf.
No, no, no,
Patricia muttered. She stood up. She could still fix this. She had to. The attack on the pipeline had lasted maybe 90 seconds. The longer this went on, the more bullets flying in wild directions, the greater the chance of a disaster that would be visible from space. The cold tore into her, and she wished she had goggles like the people trying to kill her. She could barely stand her ground, because her center of gravity kept corkscrewing downwards. It was more than just the wind and the snow in her face. everything felt wonky. She tried to imagine what it would feel like to unleash the forces of nature. What did that even mean? She couldn't even stay upright. How was she going to command any natural forces? The magnetic flux here was giving her the worst headache of her life, just when she was trying to think. What if she reached out somehow and connected to nature? Except that nature wasn't just one process. It was a whole host of processes that cascaded together in ways that nobody could predict. And if she remembered anything from her one and only conversation with that stupid tree, it was that she would be serving nature, not commanding nature. And she couldn't believe that she hadn't made that one crucial distinction clear in all her stupid conversations about her experience. And now it was too late, and they were going to die as colossal fuck-ups. She couldn't control nature. She couldn't even control herself. And this magnetic field was crushing her like a huge steely hand. She was being smushed by magnetism. A massive dog ran right at her, barking loud enough to be heard over the guns and chaos, and she was startled to realize she understood what it was saying. Mostly, "I'm going to bite your throat. You're dead." And this seemed a particularly pointless moment for her to regain the ability to understand animals, when there was no reasoning with them. And this just reminded her of the fact that she was powerless to shape or even influence the so-called forces of nature, and she really wished this magnetic flux wasn't giving her the worst migraine in the history of skulls. And then it hit her, and she knew what to do. She raised her hands to the skies and hoped for the best. Before there was a blinding crack, and Patricia woke up on board an airship, not the same one they'd stolen. She lay on a bench, and Canote was staring down at her, with a look she could only describe as wrathful on his hairless albino face. "You've disappointed me," Canote said in a flat voice. Patricia wanted to say it was all Diantha's idea, but she couldn't make herself go there. "What happened?" "Toby's dead. So are half a dozen guards at that installation you decided to attack on your own initiative. I hope you can live with that. Diantha and Samir are injured, but they'll both live. It appears you somehow tapped into the increased magnetic field at the polar region and unleashed a kind of EMP that fried not only everything electronic for a dozen miles, but also everyone's brains, including your own. You should not have been able to do that. And we're not sure how you did." "There was a dog that wanted to bite me." Her head was pounding, and she kept seeing weird shapes. Then something occurred to her. "Toby was wearing an El Tisley scarf, and we brought the airship. It had an insignia on the side." "Already dealt with. There won't be any traces to link back to the school." Canote let out a snort from deep in the pit of his stomach. "Your life is going to be very different from here on out."
"I'm so sorry."
"Not as sorry as you're going to be." He looked like he was going to say something else, like maybe offer to let her off the hook in exchange for her firstborn. But instead he just shrugged and walked away, leaving Patricia with a throbbing head and a sense of wrongs that could never be set right. She raised her head enough to see out one of the big portholes. They flew over the ocean, and the sun was falling through clouds that were a heavy, ugly purple.
Chapter 23. The parrots were eating cherry blossoms on top of a big tree on the crest of a steep hill, not far from Grace Cathedral. A half dozen bright green birds with red splotches on their heads, just tearing the shit out of these white flowers. Petals scattered across the sidewalk in the grass as the birds squawked and worked their crooked beaks, while Lawrence and Patricia watched from the steep bank of the parklet across the street. San Francisco never stopped astonishing Lawrence. Wild raccoons and possums wandered the streets, especially at night, and their shiny fur and long tails looked just like stray cats'